Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the sweet and sultry sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by...
It's Bob Bazanko in Houston, Texas. I guess this is like our scrappy tax day episode. And as always, thanks for watching and listening and share it and subscribe and hit the like button. And we've been on a roll. We've had some really great stuff going on lately, as we always do. But
we're always great. Come on, let's be honest. We're always great. I'm
trying to be humble, right? It's hard. Mac Davis said it's hard to be humble. But, we had on his longtime assistant, Bev Stoll, with some great anecdotes about Chomsky, not just professionally, but personally as well. And we've done all kinds of really great stuff on environmental actions. We have a couple of things coming out soon on policing. Just did a really nice interview with Mike Elk about the UAW vote in Chattanooga. And this is getting a lot of good ink for us. We had a great talk with Yanis Varoufakis, the famed economist and former finance minister in the Greek government, talking about his new book, Techno-Feudalism and the End of Capitalism in His Mind. I don't think we're sold on that part of it yet, but it was really a great conversation.
And Yanis was just in the news like in the last day or so.
Yeah, yesterday he was in Berlin to give a talk about the Middle East, and police bum rushed in and took and closed the event down. That sounds like 1933 German shit.
It was a talk on Palestine and Gaza, right?
It was a talk on Palestine. Yeah, and it was, if you read it, it's just what everybody says all the time. Germany has this intense guilt, right, from truly being anti-Semitic and genocidal. And so now they're atoning for it by letting Israel get away with everything at once and sending weapons there. And there's actually, the American media doesn't cover it very little, but there's also currently an ICJ case brought by Nicaragua about Germany supplying these kind of implements for genocide to Israel. And the rest of the world obviously see this very differently than the United States does. The rest of the world is condemning it. And I think it's really, I think, encouraging. You and I have been on the minority side of political issues our whole lives, but it's really quite remarkable, isn't it, to see the number of Americans now supporting Gaza, supporting the Palestinians, criticizing Israel.
It's over 55%.
It's over
55%. What I saw this week.
Yeah, so in a pretty short period of time, there has been a really remarkable shift, and I think that's a credit to the people who've been active on it.
I think it's worth noting that countries such as South Africa, which has brought the international ICJ case against Israel, and Nicaragua, which has now brought it against Germany, it's pretty significant too. At the beginning of the Ukraine war, we did an episode about how much of the Global South, global majority, whatever you want to call it, countries were against the U.S. supporting Ukraine. Very similar dynamic going on with the situation in Gaza. As you see these global North countries, these industrial countries like Germany and the United States, and aligning against the rest of the world. And it's just worth noting the sort of geopolitical dynamics that we see shifting at this point. Maybe they've already shifted, and they're just flexing their muscles a little bit.
And the countries, I think, which have been the most militant or aggressive in doing this are like South Africa, Nicaragua, Colombia, Venezuela. These are countries that have been attacked by the United States. And the United States was in the position of Israel at the time, where you had these international tribunals condemn the U.S. and the U.S. just ignored it. In the 80s, Reagan, the World Court, everything, they just ignored it. And this is what the U.S. has done for all these years. Biden falls firmly within that framework of a militarist, of an imperialist, of a war criminal. You know, what Noam said it long ago, every American president's a war criminal. And I don't see any reason to in any way disagree with that. Yeah, there's nothing, no reason to disagree with that. So anyway.
Speaking of war criminals, just to get into some of our This Week in Radical History, I just want to note that this week we celebrated the death of a very known Cold War war criminal, which is British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, died on April 8th, 2013. She was a vicious Tory leader who put the interests of her class way before those of others. She smashed working class communities and trade unions, drove through neoliberalism, and undermined the society she claimed that didn't exist. And so just want to say that, note that of the death of a longtime war criminal, as well as contribute to a whole lot of Cold War politics and invaded the
It's
Falkland
a
Islands and so
perfect counterpoint to Reagan in the 80s. It's
on.
remarkable how they sync up. You have Thatcher and Reagan, Blair and Bush,
Blair and Clinton, really.
Blair and Clinton. And pretty soon you're probably going to have Biden and Keir Starmer. British Labour is really almost indistinguishable from the US Democratic Party anymore. They're just on a tirade getting rid of not just Jeremy Corbyn, but they're really all in on this anti-Semitism frenzy, this hysteria, calling people who support Palestine anti-Semitic. It's really ugly. But yeah, Thatcher's death. I remember throughout Britain, people were screaming and yelling and singing Ding Dong, the Witch's Dead, and stuff like that. Yeah.
The next one I want to bring up is also a hero of Bob and I's. On April 9th, it was the 126th birthday of Paul Robeson, who was an American communist, radical. He was also a bass baritone concert singer. He was an actor. He was a professional football player. But he fought for civil rights. He fought for union rights. He fought against McCarthyism. He fought the blacklist. He was blacklisted. And just actually a towering figure on the left and a towering figure in American history who doesn't get his due near enough. And then on April 10th, the other item I want to bring up is April 10th is when Emiliano Zapata was assassinated by state forces in Morelos, Mexico. Zapata was a leading figure in the Mexican Revolution. He was also an inspiration for the Zapatistas, who's been an inspiration for us in the modern era. Zapata is quoted, has many quotes, but his probably best known quote is, "It's better to die upon your feet than live on your knees."
I have a couple things to mention. First, not really in any specific way, but I just want to note that on April 12th and April 14th, FDR and Abraham Lincoln died. And these are two kind of liberal icons. Liberals to this date still praise them as the two greatest presidents ever and really look up to them, which is fine. But keep in mind, too, that these guys weren't socialists. They weren't radicals. They weren't revolutionaries, despite what some people in Brooklyn would say about Lincoln. So I think we need to take that focus sometimes away from people who are elected officials. After he had a brief flurry where he moved to the left under pressure from people like Huey Long and Upton Sinclair, which again shows the need for an active left in America. But shortly after the passage of Taft-Hartley, kind of the wheels turned back in favor of labor. And in 1936, FDR was really pretty aggressively pro-labor because the CIO and the AFL handed him millions of dollars in campaign donations, but that didn't last long. And then, as far as Lincoln goes, Lincoln was kind of the handmaiden of modern American capitalism, industrial capitalism. I strongly disagree with the kind of Jacobin crowd that sees him as a revolutionary and says Reconstruction was revolutionary and radical and all that stuff. So just keep that in mind. It's okay if you want to hold them up in esteem, but they're not radicals and they're not revolutionaries. The other thing, which I just came across, and I was looking around today, on April 14th, 1939, so it's 85 years ago, The Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck's classic, was published, came a movie a year later. And when I teach, I talk about The Grapes of Wrath every semester when I discuss what I just mentioned with regard to FDR. I said to that too. FDR, despite people attacking him, how today they call people like Biden and Harris socialists, they were doing that to FDR too. And FDR was actually trying to maintain the capitalist system. And the first New Deal was very conservative and business oriented. And then he gets this attack from the left, the thunder from the left with people like Long and Sinclair. And Steinbeck is a part of that. Grapes of Wrath is a part of that. There's a great scene. And if you go look for it on YouTube, just look for Who Do We Shoot? Where a guy from the bank comes to the farm and he tells them they're going to have to leave the farm. They've lost their land. And one of the farmers who's been there forever, basically says, Who do we shoot? Which banker do we shoot? And this is part of that kind of attack on bankers, right? Woody Guthrie wrote a song called Jolly Banker at the time. But the kind of big part, I think, of the most memorable part of The Grapes of Wrath comes toward the end when Tom Joad, played brilliantly by Henry Fonda in the movie, is talking to his mother. And he's talking about how the company thugs are going to get him at some point, probably. And his mother, and he talks about the need to resist. And his mother says, You're going to kill somebody. And Tom Joad says, No, I'm not going to kill anybody. But then his mom says, What if they kill you? I'll never know about it. Then he launches into this very famous speech where he says, Maybe it's like Casey says, a fellow ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul, the one big soul that belongs to everybody. And then his mom says, Then what? And he says, Then it don't matter. I'll be around in the dark. I'll be everywhere. Wherever you can look, wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be there in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be there in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too. That's just a really, I think, beautiful sentiment with regard to the kind of sense of community and solidarity that many of us have.
Right. There's a great Woody Guthrie song about with that speech too, as part of the lyrics too.
And Springsteen too. Yep. The Ghost of Tom Joad, right?
Yep.
And I think it's really, really quite beautiful and telling. And I think that's that spiritual part of the left is really important, which we don't really talk about too much now. The left has been bogged down and we're under attack all the time from everybody, right? You have the crazy right-wingers calling us a bunch of anti-Semitic, socialist, radical, whatever. And you have the Democrats basically saying the same thing, but the spirit, I think that kind of spiritual side of it, this idea that we're all part of this larger community and we're all in this together, and we have this kind of collective spirit, this collective soul, is really important. And that's just really a moving, a very powerful movie. When we did our best political movies of all time, that was clearly in the, I think it was in the Hall of Fame category for us.
Right.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend it. But the novel was published 85 years ago today.
Yeah, and I definitely, in where we see these moments of the left in America today, or these pockets of the left, I feel that sort of sentiment that we're not all just a single soul, but we're all one big soul working on these things together.
Yeah. I think amid these atrocities in Gaza, which are just, harder to look at every day, the one thing that's come out of that is this kind of the whole world is on this same line with regard to that's neat to see so many people so all over the world now who are in small towns in the United States and obviously in the Middle East, in Europe, everywhere are speaking up, and they have the same level of ferocity with regard to their anger and horror at what Israel is doing, and the sympathy and support and love for a lot of the Palestinians. So I think that's what that speech with Tom Joad is talking about, that we're all part of this together. And if children are being killed in Gaza, that affects us in our hearts, wherever we are.
Yeah, totally.
And now on to the real stuff.
Yeah, let's hit the real stuff. Do you want to start with NPR?
And then let me start with something else, because we lost a legend this week in O.J. Simpson. And we can make all kinds of jokes about that, and they're all over social media. And it reminds me, again, I'm probably an outlier here, I never thought Norm Macdonald was funny, and seeing all the clips of him reinforces that for me. Not funny at all. But at any rate, why is O.J. Simpson important? O.J. Simpson, I think, had a lot to do with the kind of racial politics in the United States. And I think in that regard, it actually has some real meaning. Simpson, the Simpson murders occurred only 2 years after the Rodney King incident, right? And remember, after the Rodney King trial, in 1992, the police were acquitted and South Central blew up. I think at the time it was the largest urban uprising in U.S. history in terms of damage and people killed and all that.
And it was definitely the biggest since the 60s, since Newark and Detroit Watts.
It may not have been. I think the 1968 national uprising after King's death made it bigger, but it's huge. And so L.A. is really, from that point on, that kind of the racial calculus in L.A. was pretty conflict, kind of incendiary, right? It's ready to blow up at any minute, because obviously in the aftermath of that verdict, South Central blew up and racial politics remained really difficult from that point onward. And then you have the O.J. murders and then the O.J. trial. And I don't think it was just like Johnny Cochran and O.J.'s lawyers who turned this into a racial incident, right? Because let's face it, O.J. Simpson, O.J. himself, used to say, this is O.J. Simpson saying, I'm not black, I'm a millionaire, or I'm not black, I'm O.J., right? Right. He identified as part of that. And that's really, so this is a guy who has enough money to buy Johnny Cochran, Effie Bailey, and Kardashian to be his lawyers. Very few people can do that, right? This guy was the spokesman for corporations, his first black spokesman for a big corporation when he did Hertz Rent-A-Car. So he's part of that. But then you start to see the coverage of it by everybody flip away from this kind of heinous crime and what really happened to these really hardcore issues of race. And African-American community in a lot of places turned OJ into kind of a litmus test. And they cheered when he was acquitted. And then I think to a large degree, a lot of kind of the white establishment was okay with that too, because it diffracted attention away from what was really happening in Black America, right? So you could focus on, and then when OJ is acquitted, it appeases people and it's a way to distract away from other issues that you're doing. So I think the OJ trial really did have significant meaning.
I would also throw one other thing on there, is where we have this during that period, we have this sort of nascent rising, like disgruntled white men and women go moving further and further to the right, is that they also saw OJ getting away with it as a, this is just part of the, this is part of the liberal establishment. This is like the liberal media goes nuts about this, the liberal judiciary. We have a Democratic president who's trying to explain it to America at the time. And and Mark Furman is definitely cast as a villain who's a Los Angeles police detective who had a history of racial bias against other black people. And so it also fuels that like growing anger that you see on Fox News in that period, which like it just got bigger and bigger. And I actually feel like it's the some of the root of the current MAGA culture stuff going on as well.
Yeah, it really had significant cultural meaning. You can laugh about it and joke about it all we want, but I think it really did have a lot to say about the changing nature of racial politics in the United States. Because well, 1995 isn't, it's about the same length in time from the 1960s as it is today, right? So the 60s wasn't that far away when you had this kind of spirit of uplift and equity and civil rights laws and all that kind of stuff. And by the mid 90s, it's pretty much over. And that kind of the resentments are coming back. And I think the OJ trial just brought out, like I said, it's a litmus test. It's a OJ is different, is something different. He's like Zelig, right? He's different to everybody who encounters him. And especially in terms of racial identity and racial politics, right? And in that regard, I think it is. I think it really had some meaning. Certain incidents like that, you think about actually the Sacco and Vanzetti, the murders in Braintree that were pinned on Sacco and Vanzetti occurred, I think, in this time period too, in mid-April. And it's like that, right? You have this national uproar and this, but Sacco and Vanzetti obviously could never have afforded 1920s versions of Effie Bailey and Johnny Cochran and Kardashian and those guys. Right? And just the whole thing, the judge was Marsha Clark, and what's the guy's name? The lawyer, the DAs were publicity hounds, and the judge is an attention whore, and it was just a real charade, a real farce. And it did. It just, everybody used it. And it set everybody back, I think.
100%, absolutely. Clarence Darrow, they couldn't, Sacco and Vanzetti, they couldn't afford him, right, at the time.
Anyway, it's funny. And when I first saw it, I said, I should mention OJ. And so just joking, but in reality, I think it actually does have some meaning. So.
And it's a, it, there was an iconic, there's iconic moments that come out of that as well. Like the white Bronco, the slow motion chase down the LA freeway, and him standing in front of the jury where the gloves don't fit his hands. Johnny, lots of stuff with Johnny Cochran.
How many car chases like that have ended in people being shot and killed by the cops,
Right.
right?
Especially if they're
Without,
black.
right. I just a couple of days ago, as somebody I mentioned about last year, there's a NBA basketball player, really a young guy, he's very well known, named John Morant. He's been in all kinds of trouble for flashing guns around and shit like that. But he was actually on trial because he beat up basically a 17-year-old kid, and the judge ruled it was self-defense. Again, you have like young black people who are really being churned around in the justice system. But if you have some money, you have some money no matter what you are. You could be OJ, you could be John Morant, you could be guys on the Alabama basketball team who brought a gun to somebody who used it to kill somebody. Nothing happens to you. And I think, again, this reinforces this idea that class matters, that people who have money matter, that people who have are affluent matter, and not everything is just based on race. And obviously, people like O.J. Simpson and John Morant were able to transcend that because they had enough money to do what rich people do when they're in trouble, which is essentially to buy their way out of it, right? The other thing, which is a vaguer but larger point, is that this week, NPR is currently in turmoil. That's the word that all the media is using, because a senior editor there named Uri Berliner came out and said that NPR is biased toward liberals. And they're going too easy on Hamas, and they're too harsh against Israel, and they just have a bunch of editorial, homogeneity where everybody is saying the same thing, which is probably true. But it also speaks to that kind of whole idea, doesn't it, of being even-handed and being balanced, which is the trap that a lot of people, including liberals, especially liberals, I think, fall into, right? You have this idea that if you're going to criticize Israel, you have to criticize Hamas the same amount. Right, which was ridiculous because the events are very different. And The whole idea when people are challenging, you must condemn Hamas, you condemn Hamas. I mean, you can do it, you're not. I mean, Norman Finkelstein has called Hamas, has said Hamas committed atrocities that day, when I would think he's certainly not the kind of guy who would be unbiased about this kind of thing, right? But they want this kind of equal, balanced treatment, and that's just not the way the world works. And it's really frustrating to see that, because the United States just continually moves further and further to the right all the time. And when you have NPR, which is a bad, that's tote bag liberalism, right? NPR is the kind of the founder of that whole idea of tote bag, what I call tote bag liberalism, right?
Right.
And
the NPR tote bag is
it's
what
the NPR tote
when
bag.
we say it, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. And so to attack NPR and put them on the defensive now, because they're actually doing what they should be doing as journalists, which is looking into what's actually happening, looking into the reality of what's happening in Palestine.
Yeah.
And reporting stuff that the freaking IDF is posting on Twitter to brag about.
TikTok is for
it. This is not really hardcore investigative journalism. The IDF is telling you, they're bragging about what they do. And you see these images and pictures of children being killed and, you know, bodies being run over, the Al-Shifa massacre. And for NPR, this bastion of liberal thought to come under attack now as being unbalanced or being too liberal, I think really says a lot about kind of political dialogue in the United States and about the media. And again, I think this is, we're not talking about Fox News or Newsmax. We know what they're like, right? But the mainstream media, look at just the basic New York Times, WAPO coverage. They're slowly coming around because you can't ignore reality that much, and putting more stuff in about what Israel's actually doing. But to be able to, but every time you do that, there's a price to pay. So you have this guy from NPR, Uri Berliner, saying that NPR is too, they're anti-Zionist. And I don't think he called them anti-Semitic, but it's not far
too,
away from
too
that.
Soft on Hamas.
Too soft on Hamas. The one thing about that, which is, I think, a trap people on the left fall into, who gives a shit if you condemn Hamas? Does Hamas care? If you and I have a show where we just condemn Hamas the whole time, who gives a shit? What difference does it make? It means nothing. It means absolutely zero. It's freaking masturbatory performative politics, right?
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
So if you want to give them a fine, it just really doesn't matter. It's inconsequential. But you see that. And I was just yesterday in class, I was talking about how the United States became a right-wing country after the 60s. And you see the same stuff going on now, these kind of media contrived crises and controversies and this idea that we have to be equal and even-minded. And in every case, it's also liberal weakness, liberal fecklessness, which we're seeing in abundantly right now. So,
didn't Abby Hoffman talk about the problem with liberals as they see both sides of the argument?
Yeah. Which, you know, there's not, intellectually, there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, you also can make a decision. And not everything is equal. That's not the way, like, people as historians will say, you're not balanced. History doesn't occur in a balanced fashion, right?
Yeah.
Really, I don't like making Nazi analogies because I think they're easy and just most people just roll their eyes. You can't argue like positively about the Nazis. Oh, the Nazis killed millions of people. And now for the pro-Nazi point of view, here's David Duke and Donald Trump or whatever. Right? You don't do that. And so Israel should not be held to different standards. I'm not saying Israel's doing things absolutely that will remind you of wartime atrocities, not just the U.S. and Vietnam.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those things happen, right? There's a lot of things, they may not have been on the same scale as what Germany did in World War II, but they were as horrific. The U.S. and Vietnam would clearly be an example. What's happening in Haiti right now would be an example of that. I just think that, you know,
or Russia and Ukraine.
Russia and Ukraine, right? This is the way empires and big countries fight wars. But I think it's dangerous now when you have NPRs be thrown into the corner and intimidated, and I think it's just inevitable at some point you're going to see a shift in their coverage now. And one person can do this, a senior editor at NPR News. And there's NPR is under no obligation to have 50% conservatives and 50% liberals. And conservatives nowadays are batshit crazy. We're not having disagreements over marginal tax rates or how much you should spend to clean up the environment. Or we're talking about like killing people abundantly, supplying the weapons to kill people. We're talking about Israel destroying people, killing doctors, blowing up hospitals, blowing up aid workers, killing children, sniping at people. There's snipers killing people. And then mocking people who are dead by holding up their underwear and going into their homes and eating food and stuff like that. And the idea that like NPR has some kind of responsibility to be balanced. You know, you have to be fair. You have to tell the truth. But balance means you do 50% one side, 50. That's bullshit. That's not the way history works. Yeah. Nothing works that way. I cannot in any way find any reason to like justify the U.S. and the Vietnam War. It's something I know quite well. Right? There's no balance there. It just can't be done. And a lot of people do it. A lot of the new literature on Vietnam does it, right?
Yeah.
But it's just not there. And at some point, you have to call out the people who are actually responsible for all of this death and destruction. And in this case, it's Israel with the United States subsidizing it and providing political cover and providing weapons and on all of that. Yeah, it's really disheartening to see these attacks, which just work all the time. Liberals, they're going to cave, and you're going to see NPR now kind of drift, I think, into different territory. I also think it doesn't matter. This is one time when social media really is valuable, because the fact that the mainstream media is covering up in some ways IDF propaganda has been overtaken, because we see these immediate images now on Twitter and on TikTok and Instagram and all these places where every day it's horrific, right? You wake up and you start to see these images of what's happening there. And that's, they've just gone, it's a workaround. So you don't have to worry about, you don't have to focus on what the Washington Post or the New York Times or the networks or anybody says, because it's there in real time. And that's the thing that's striking, right? This guy from NPR wants them to be more balanced. The fucking reality of Gaza is not balanced. It is a pogrom. It is an ethnic cleansing. It is a massive atrocity. It's a genocide. And so you can't be neutral about that. And so this is really disheartening. And I think, hopefully not, but I think liberals are going to just shift again to make sure that they're not attacked and people don't say bad things about it.
It, their feelings get hurt and they have to shift the way they do things. Speaking about the war, going to go into the next topic. Speaking about the war, who's profit from it? Who's being subsidized to support it? About a week ago, you may have seen this on our social media. We had a direct action here in the Bay Area down in Sunnyvale, which is down just north of San Jose. So it's Silicon Valley. Lockheed Martin facility down next to Moffett Field. Moffett Field is one of the places where the space shuttle goes. It's where Air Force One flies into when the president comes to the Bay Area. And right next to it is a pretty big Lockheed Martin campus where they do research and development. Lockheed Martin is the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, bar none. They supply Israel with F-16s, F-35s, Hellfire missiles, and lots of other weapons. We know in the past that this campus down in Sunnyvale had actually developed some of the software for the F-35. We're not sure if it's still happening, but we know that there is a history of that. Human rights experts have condemned Israel's action as a genocide. Lockheed Martin's F-35 Lightning II is the most lethal fighter jet in the world, according to Lockheed Martin. The Hellfire missiles have been used recently in Gaza to assassinate journalists, health workers, hospitals, and other critical infrastructure. And so that's what we're looking at, what's going on down in Sunnyvale. We did a pretty big protest where we blocked all entrances into this Sunnyvale facility. Lockheed Martin last year reported $67 billion in profits. Back at the beginning of 2022, before the Russians invaded Ukraine, I believe it was the Lockheed CEO who actually got caught on tape during a stock analyst's basically bragging about how, because of like forthcoming wars, they were actually looking at having some pretty banner years, right? I just want to say that the purpose of this company, I know they also make things for civilian aircraft, they make things for the space program, but a lot of their revenue is coming from U.S. government subsidized programs to develop weapons of war, which they sell to the U.S. military, which they sell to other militaries, including the Israeli military. It was on November 9th, it was an Israeli military which hit journalists near the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. This particular Hellfire missile was developed for the CIA to carry out assassinations. Israel used it to kill Palestinian journalists. On December 11th, the Israeli Air Force used a Lockheed Martin C-130 to drop approximately 7 tons of equipment to Israeli soldiers engaging in ground attacks in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. This was the first operational airdrop that Israel had carried out since 2006 when they had gone to war in Lebanon. In December 28th, Lockheed was awarded another $10 million contract for continued support for Israel's fleet of F-35s. And like I said, last week, we blockaded Lockheed's campus in Sunnyvale, California. Over 200 of us shut the facility down. We blocked off the entrances. By midday, Lockheed sent a message to their employees telling them just to work from home and not to bother coming in and engaging with anti-genocide protesters. We actually ended up with no arrests. The Sunnyvale police just sat around and watched us in their cars and drank coffee, to be honest. Not a surprise because, you know, they're, you know, that's what cops are pretty good for, is just sitting around while crime's going on, according to them anyway. We did have to deal with angry Lockheed workers. And there was one incident which has gotten a lot of media attention, where a Lockheed Martin employee tried to run through a blockade of protesters. I'm going to show this video. I will say that it is somewhat intense.
You are telling you right there.
Are you going to hurt people? We have eyes on you, sir. Don't do this. We have eyes on you.
And nothing happened to the guy who pulled the knife?
As far as we know, no. This got such media traction. It was on Al Jazeera. It was in Newsweek. It was in all the local Bay Area media, this particular video, that Lockheed responded to journalists asking about the person. Lockheed responded saying that they actually have a code of ethics within their company and they would be investigating violations of that code of ethics. And of course, Lockheed respects peaceful protest.
A few weeks ago, at your way, in your backyard, wasn't somebody charged with a felony for literally a drop of paint at Pelosi's protest landing on a cop? They were charged with
battery
against a police officer. This guy pulls a knife. Yeah, it is intense.
And he was running his car towards people sitting down and chained to each other.
Yeah, it's weird. When I saw him, there used to be this character in one of those crazy supermarket tabloids called Ed Anker. And that's what he looks like. That's what he reminds me of, right? Or remember the guy in Charlie Sheen's second show, Anger Management, the crazy kind of redneck guy? I forget his name, but he reminds me of him too. So. But no,
he reminds me of every other white guy you meet in Texas, actually.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it's intense, right? But that's the point of it. You're trying to create a confrontation, but you're not there violent and you're not there with guns and weapons stuff. So when you pull a knife on somebody, that definitely ratchets things up. Yeah. And obviously, if somebody on your side of the protest had done that, you would have been immediately arrested. But
the cops sat there and watched this too, is my understanding.
Yeah.
I'm not like a therapist or psychologist or anything by any means, but I also just think this speaks a little bit about how working for, he clearly worked at Lockheed. He clearly worked on that campus. Maybe, I don't know if he was a contractor, if he was a employee proper, but clearly like working in the military industrial complex does something to poison your mind and spirit, where you feel like you have to get to work and you have to kill somebody to get to work. It's just disturbing. Yeah.
The thing about that is, man, that's a day off. Just go home. They're going to pay you.
That's certainly what happened. I will say that the blockade where I was is that we had lots of people come up pretty aggro. No one to this level, but we had a lot of people come up pretty aggro because they couldn't get into work. Different than where this incident happened is the gate we were at, Lockheed closed the gates and locked them. And it was like right up on the street where I think this was at the front of a long road you go in to get into the campus.
But I think these companies, they have immense power. At the end of the day, nothing's really going to happen. But they're clearly under siege as well. And I think they know that and they feel it. Were you going to say more about Lockheed? Or I just want to make a kind of a peripheral point, because that also speaks, I think, to another one of the biggest issues we have going on today, which is Boeing, right? And Boeing's airplanes. And I only say that because I think what's happening at Boeing right now is,
and that's really the second largest war manufacturer.
Right. And it's a great example of how capitalism works, right? They were using Dawn dish soap in lieu of oil. They were using duct tape. And we've seen, I don't know how many, this has been going on for over a month. And just a few days ago, a flight had to stop, a flight from Houston to Denver had to stop and go back because a door or something was falling off. My favorite part of this whole thing was when I was in the New York Times, one of the papers said something like, Boeing is trying to straddle the line between safety and profits, right? We ain't talking about freaking lawn darts here, which were outlawed in the 1980s, right? We're talking about airplanes. It's like guns and airplanes. There's no safety profits. Doesn't matter. You don't get that. You don't get to invoke that when you're talking about weapons and these kinds of things. It's when I think of Boeing and Lockheed. I'm sorry, when you mentioned Lockheed, I thought of Boeing and just how, you know, atrocious that situation is too. So fortunately, on my next flight, I already booked an Airbus.
Sometimes being a Francophile is pays off.
Yeah.
What I wanted to segue with the Lockheed bit was to what our theme of the day is, which is around tax day. And I'll say this is that it's a U.S. program that subsidizes Lockheed to be able to create and sell weapons to the Israelis. But also the U.S. gives billions of dollars to the Israelis, and that's billions of your tax dollars that go to the Israelis. The total aid the U.S. has and will be given Israel in 2023 and 2024 will be about $18 billion. Since 2003, the U.S. has provided $7 billion in aid to Israel, which is about $333 billion when you adjust for inflation. I just want to say that's like a huge amount of money. There was like an article I read that was making a point about how much of my tax money actually goes to the Israelis, which is 0.4% of the overall federal budget, which is about $4.5 trillion. $18 billion goes to the Israelis. Overall budget is $4.5 trillion. About 4.4% of that is going to Israel, which is probably in the scheme of things for people like us, it's $150 a year. But if you have 300 plus million people who are paying taxes, that's a whole lot of money going to the Israelis from the American people. And it's not coming from corporate profit. It's not necessarily coming from billionaires, because we know they all have all sorts of accounting means to get out of paying taxes. It's from the middle class and the lower middle class and the working class. And tax day is actually something where you should really think about what your money is going to when you pay your taxes. And there's a long history of tax resistance, which I won't go into. I will say that there are organizations. There's the War Resisters League. There's like the National Committee on Tax Resistance. Henry David Thoreau was an early tax resister who spent a night in jail after his refusal to pay the Massachusetts poll because he didn't want to pay, because he was opposed to slavery and he was opposed to imperialist and unjust war in places like Mexico, which was happening during the time in which he lived. But it led him to write On the Duty of Civil Disobedience. In it, he said, if 1,000 men were not to pay their tax bills this year, that would not be a violent and bloody measure. It would be to pay them and enable the state commit violence and shed innocent blood. This is, in fact, the definition of a peaceful revolution, if any such is possible.
You mentioned the money going to Israel. It's also striking and important to note that inside Israel, they have fully covered healthcare and education, and they have all these social programs that here in the United States, Biden and others just tell us that they're non-starters. So we're subsidizing Israel's welfare programs, while here we're simply told to just get over it and STFU. So,
yes, it's rugged individualism for the masses, socialism for the classes here.
Yeah. Yep. Remember many years ago, we did the Billionaires for Bush thing on tax day. That was fun.
Yeah. Everyone always just like worries about their taxes because it's something that happens where the IRS pings you or whatever, but there's actually not enough of a conversation going on about like tax day. That street theater bit, which you referenced there, was actually pretty brilliant.
Yeah, it
was at the heyday of the Iraq War when we did that.
Yeah.
And so we were bringing up some of the same issues. And that's when tax resistance like surges, is when you have a big war. Like there was a whole lot of stuff around tax resistance during Vietnam and during the Reagan Cold War era and during the Iraq War. But then it rescinds and those groups and that sort of movement dies down a little bit. And then I'm sure it's resurged again right now in the last 6 months.
The face of tax resistance in the United States is Donald Trump.
Right.
He's like, only dummies pay taxes. I'm smart. I don't pay taxes.
He can also afford an army of accountants, although they all seem to be going to jail. They're all going to jail.
I don't know. That army of lawyers he has, they keep shedding off. So,
yeah.
No, there's just so much involved in this. But yeah, the tax system really is really a big form of class war, obviously. If you have a decent income and you can afford just even a low-level accountant, they're going to save you a ton of money. And obviously, when you get to the corporate level, they have a million different write-offs and loopholes, so they're not paying anything. And so when we say that as Americans, we're paying to subsidize Israel's atrocity, that's true. It's true, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of, not everything, right? A lot of that is just money they invented. I mean, the Fed just invents money too. But that money they invent, the Fed is now saying they're not going to cut interest rates and inflation isn't over. The reason they did that is because the jobs report was better than expected. Employment and wages are bad for the ruling class. When people are work, when unemployment is low, when people make money, the ruling class sees that as a threat. And that's why they're raising rates or they're not cutting rates. And so it's a form of class warfare. The tax system is clearly a huge form of class war in the United States. And that's something to keep in mind, too. Anyway, it's some kind of a bleak time, as always.
Yep. Stay humble. Hard to be humble.
It's hard to be humble. I try. Okay. I'll put this on in anticipation of our final segue. So.
Hey, folks, you've been listening to the Green and Red podcast talking about war and taxes.
War. What is it good for?
Or what is it good for? Death and taxes too. OJ, death and taxes. Maybe that'll be our title this week. So if you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you are watching this on YouTube, hit subscribe. If you're listening to us on one of the many audio platforms we're on, give us a rate and review. And then if you really like us, hit that support button at greenandredpodcast.org or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And as you can tell, we have swag. We've been, while they last, we have Green and Red Podcast trucker hats that Bob and I are both wearing right now. For $25, just email greenredpodcast@gmail.com and you can get a green and red hat. And if you have $35 and you haven't read Bob's first book yet, Masters of War, please send us $35 and email us at greenredpodcast@gmail.com and you will get a copy of that book. And we're just like, got lots of swag here. We got lots of stuff to give away to you. So we're not give away to you. We give it away to you once you've given us a donation. And don't pay your taxes. Give the money to the Green and Red Podcast. That's the way. That's the message of the day. Don't give money to subsidize Netanyahu's war in Gaza. Give it to the Green and Red Podcast.
Let me be immodest for a moment, even though, you know, like I said, it's hard to be humble, but because we've been doing a lot of stuff on the JFK conspiracy, we have another show coming up not too far away on conspiracies in general, because I think they're damaging to the left. But if you're interested in the JFK stuff, there's some good things in here, which proves so conclusively that Kennedy was in no way trying to get out of Vietnam. He was fully committed to the war there. And when Oliver Stone's crew, Pinto, Flounder, Morley, and all these folks go off on it, they simply ignore data. They ignore all the evidence, all the archives, all the documents. And they talk about anecdotes and what somebody said to somebody else 40 years ago and magic bullets and people who suddenly have recovered memory after 60 years that there was a bullet on Kennedy's gurney and silly shit like that. But in here, there's a couple chapters on JFK and Vietnam. And after you read those, if you're open-minded, if you know how to read documents, it is clear there's zero evidence that Kennedy was in any way trying to get out of Vietnam. So I would, if you're interested in that especially, but if you're interested in the Vietnam War, it's a good book. I'm proud of it. And I'm very proud because the back blurb came from the amazing and legendary Seymour Hersh. And so that's always been a source of pride for me too. So anyway, just check it out.
Yep. And until next time, everybody go out and cause some trouble and misbehave, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Back a few months ago, I was headlining at a great big nightclub. And he put me up a couple of days early. I came in a couple of days early, and they put me up at what they call the Star Suite. Now, here I am, headliner in one of the biggest nightclubs in the country, and I wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning in this Star Suite all by myself. Yeah, that's what I said, aw. But I did what I've always done, man, to cheer myself up. I picked up my guitar, I sat down, I wrote me a little song. Now this is how it feels to be alone at the top of the hill and trying to figure out why. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day.
To know me is to love me. I must be a hell of a man. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble, but I'm doing the best that I can. I use